report a little bit how it's going with doing the concentration practice over the last couple of weeks, or questions you have about any of it that's related to this. This is a good time.
Start. I get a question about the very last line of the Metta Sutta. He's not born again into this world. Are there different ways of interpreting that?
Oh, certainly. That's, of course, this is religion.
Okay. What's a way of interpreting it that has to do with now?
The word in Pali is, I forget the Pali word, but it means not again reborn in a womb, is the expression. What it refers to is in Indian cosmology, the idea of liberation is to actually not just liberated in this life, but you're liberated from the cycles of rebirthing, being born over and over again. And so you're no longer reborn as a human being, no reborn in a womb. And so you're either freed and no longer reborn at all, or you get reborn. If you really had to cultivate metta to a high degree and attain the level of attainment they talk about in the sutta, then you might not be an arhat yet, but you might be a non-returner. And non-returner is someone who gets reborn in a very pristine, rarefied celestial realm for their last birth. And there's you don't get spontaneous appearance in these heavenly worlds. You don't go through gestation and birth from a womb. So that's the most traditional interpretation of this line.
That one doesn't work too well for me.
So if we want to interpret it for ourselves, you know, in much more contemporary language, it works for a lot of Westerners. It's no longer, I like the interpretation, no longer gets reborn in the cycles of suffering. So that you no longer get reborn in the cycles of identity, of becoming, that we cling to and hold on to, by which we suffer.
Even moment to moment.
Moment to moment, yeah. Sort of right. Reborn. Right.
Yeah. Okay. That works better. I can kind of grok that.
Gil, I have a question about which is more skillful, to follow concentration Bhagavan solely, using that as the only form of meditation, and just go as far, push that as far as possible, versus insight meditation, metta, whatever. So in other words, going back and forth. You know, Mondays you do concentration, Tuesdays you do insight. You get the point. But moving back and forth versus staying with one form and going as deep as you can with it.
To kind of take the question at the most broadest level first, or at least maybe my own bias to how I listen to that kind of question, and that is that religious people really love simple answers. This is the one way. This is the right way. So it's the concentration way. That's the way. Or this is the way. And the way you asked the question was very generally like, how do you know what's skillful? As if there's some answer separate from the individual. There's some abstract floating answer to that question. The answer to that question has to be within each individual person who addresses it for themselves. When we're aware of our own tendencies, our own strengths and weaknesses, our own issues we're dealing with, our own sense of how the practice unfolds for us as individuals, that's when we find what's skillful and what's not skillful.
So, would it make sense then to experiment with moving back and forth for a while versus for a similar period of time just go one route and see which deepens each form?
Yeah, I think a lot of Buddhist practice is a matter of trial and error. And finding out by trial and error what works and what doesn't work, finding out what the consequences are of doing different kinds of practices or different ways, different approaches, learning from those and finding one's own way in a sense. But it's also good to get to talk to a teacher and talk about what's going on in your own life, your own practice, your own mind, and to get some guidance, because there's so much you can choose from otherwise that it can be a challenge to kind of, in your endless trial and error, it's nice to hone it down a little bit. And a lot of, sometimes it depends on the abilities of a certain person. Some people have very, very good abilities to get concentrated, and the concentration route can really help them out. Other people have really good abilities to get concentrated, but they hide in that concentration state. And they need, you know, they can stay there for years, kind of hiding, and you need a good teacher to kind of shake them up. Some people have naturally no very, very poor ability to get concentrated, or maybe because of their historical reasons, they have very poor ability to get concentrated. And so they're better actually directed away from concentration paths, as a really serious path in itself to develop the absorptions and all that, and are better off encouraging to do Vipassana. Some people are, if a teacher is really tracking someone who's brand new, they might suggest that that person should start with Vipassana and then switch over to concentration for a while and then go back to Vipassana. Or for another person, they might say, you should start with concentration, then do Vipassana. And there's all these different combinations of how these things this can unfold. So the question is, what is it for you? And what's skillful for you is really the issue. And trial and error is one way. And my suggestion in offering this class is that a lot of people could use more concentration. It's almost a safe thing to say. Almost everyone can use a little more concentration. And I'm not offering this class as saying, then okay, now some, you're supposed to be on the samadhi path. For the next 10 years, all you do is concentration practice. I'd be very happy if someone took a 5-week class, did concentration practice during these 5 weeks, learned something about concentration, appreciated it and some aspects of it, and then were able to and develop a little bit of concentration, more concentration than they have. So when they go back to Vipassana practice, they bring along a little bit more emphasis on concentration as a support for that Vipassana practice. Some of you might decide to spend a year just doing concentration practice based on this class, and that might be a really wise thing to do. And some people might take it further and go on concentration retreats. And there's a whole range of things. So without sitting down with you personally, it's hard for me to give a generic answer to your question. But is that kind of helpful to kind of...
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Yeah.
I probably asked this before, but I have a hard time understanding how to apply investigation to concentration without getting contemplated. I'm not quite sure how you meant that.
But it's okay for it to be contemplative.
It doesn't feel like I'm doing concentration.
What you want to do for it depends a lot on the depth of your concentration, but what you want to do with concentration practice is you want everything, all your faculties, supporting each other, supporting the possibility of getting concentrated. If you have a lot of discursive thought and you can't sit down and settle because there's a lot of thinking going on, then if you can't stop the thinking very easily, then start thinking about your breath. So you're using that tendency, it's kind of like doing Aikido. Rather than kind of keep drifting off and thinking about other things, you start using that to fill that energy of thinking with thinking about the breath. So at least the faculty of thinking is directed towards the breath. And it might be very discursive then, because that's what you have to work with. And then with time, you get more and more settled. As you get more settled, it might be that you feel that kind of discursive activity gets in the way of further settling. You have to let go of it. But you don't have to let go of it, immediately. If it can actually, everything can be helpful in its own time and place. Now, investigation, even when the mind is quite quiet and concentrated, investigation can be part of the practice. And how to do it so it's not discursive. I don't think there's a sharp line between a completely silent mind and a mind which thinks. The thinking gets more and more subtle. And sometimes it gets so subtle that some people don't even recognize their thinking. But there is some processing going on there in the mind. And, you know, it looks nothing like the normal kind of way in which we talk to ourselves in the brain. And that, you know, that kind of, you think that part of the mind is completely silent. You know, there's no indication, no inclination to start talking to yourself, self-talk. But there's still a very, very subtle kind of discursive quality going on. So there's kind of a spectrum from discursive activity to silence. And I don't know if we ever get to silence, except maybe in some very, very rarefied states. You probably do non-discursive, non-contemplative investigation already. And so what you might do is rather than try to figure out how to do it, be very still and notice how you already do it. And then from that, you might then learn how to do it better in a way that's helpful. So for example, it might be simple as you're sitting here and you notice, you know, you're sitting here, you're concentrating on your breath, and you have this very simple noticing that when you're sitting here with your breathing, that you're a little bit slumped over and it's a little bit, you know, a little bit more forced, the breathing, because of that. And so you sit up a little bit straighter. And there's almost no thought involved. Maybe, you know, from normal kinds of ideas, there's no thought at all involved. But there was an investigation, there was recognition of what was there, there was discrimination of what was going on, what was needed, and you adjusted. That involves a factor of investigation. So you're probably doing that a lot. And it's not very discursive or contemplative. And what you want to do is utilize that kind of natural ability a little bit more when it's helpful. And not use it when it becomes, you know, is constant tinkering with our experience and trying to change things, make things better. And there's and with concentration practice, there's a balance between knowing how to adjust and change and, you know, work with a kind of ecology of the mind, and when not to do that, and just be very receptive and peaceful, not do anything at all. And again, it's not like a one right way, but rather you have to kind of be able to, by trial and error, find what you need at any given time, which makes it a little bit more demanding for the practitioner, because you have to be engaged and you make mistakes and sometimes you get tired out or by doing that. But I think it's much more realistic, and you go much further if you feel like you're engaged in that way. So strategically, you decide when to be rest with the breath and be very passive and receptive and not try to make anything happen. And then, you know, sometimes that's really helpful, and sometimes that's not helpful. And so you want to, you know. Is that making sense?
Yeah.
So what you find, I think, in a lot of American meditation teachers, there's a strong emphasis on using language like just rest with the breath, don't do anything, just accept things how they are, don't change. And some of that's a function of most Americans are too hyper, concerned about, you know, progress and making things and changing things and judging things. And so they just need kind of as an antidote, you know, just to relax. So probably most of us here need that teaching, just relax. But we shouldn't take that to be the ultimate teaching. You know, the ultimate teaching is just relax. That's just an antidote to, you know, it's the medicine for us. But you can, you know, at some point you can get too relaxed, and you need to also then bring in more effort and more energy. And if all you hear is relax, then you're not, you know, you're not involved. There's an active and a passive side to meditation. And hopefully you have the wisdom to know when to use the different types, the different aspects, active or passive. And the active parts are really beautiful, as are the passive. Yeah?
I have a question about bringing some of this into to real world living relative to the sun. And I was talking to a friend who does a lot of concentration meditation, and she was recommending using more of those practices when I'm faced with a family situation. Was And an antidote useful to keep me on a better mind state. I'm not quite sure how to do that.
Well, I think, again, trial and error, try different ways. In certain circumstances, the best thing you can do is more vipassana, which involves a number of things. It could involve just kind of maybe open, receptive to all things. It can also be involved very carefully paying attention to what goes on inside of you in those situations. How is it you get pulled into other people's mind states or other people's emotions or feelings? What is it inside of you that's happening? Is there fear? Is there some kind of unhealthy sense of identification with others? Is there a sense of responsibility trying to take care of others? What's going on inside of you? What are the personal psychological dynamics you have? And vipassana can help, you know, you be open to that and explore that and get to know it so that those don't trigger those kinds of problems. Or you might find that you've tried that and it doesn't seem to help much, and you find, well, maybe what you need to do is have some strength of, you want to enter those situations calm, with some strength of concentration. And so you practice concentration practice in order to get really calm. And then hopefully that calm gives you a better overview of what's going on in the situation. You're not going to get caught because of the strength of the calm. Or you do both. You do calm going into the situation and you switch to vipassana doing it. Or you simply continue doing a concentration practice in the middle of the family issue. Just follow your breath. Hang on, you know, hang on to the breath for dear life. It's the only thing that saves them. You know, otherwise they're going to punch someone out. You know, so they just breathe and breathe. So what I'm suggesting from this kind of point of view of practices I'm giving in this class is that it's nice to have a repertoire of different tools that you can use, and then to know when the different tools are most useful. And concentration is always helpful to a certain degree. But what happens with concentration is that, to some degree, concentration practice by itself is a practice of suppression, or avoidance. You're avoiding certain issues. And sometimes you can get calm and concentrated so you can look at these issues more carefully, more realistically. But sometimes it is a kind of, you're holding everything at bay. You can get really deeply concentrated. And sometimes it can actually be counterproductive, because the power of suppression or exclusion that goes on in very strong samadhi practice somehow seems to let the suppressed reactions come back with greater force once the concentration wanes, and so suddenly a person's much more angry because of that repression that was going on. Yeah.
That might kind of counteract a little bit of what you're saying. But all the loving kindness phrases I've got are too long to keep in mind. May I be at peace? I am the person's talking, that's too long.
So loving kindness is a great practice because it has the function of not only being a concentration practice, but it also helps condition, reminds us of a different intention of how to meet people. So it's a nice reminder, I think kindness is good here. Not just stay calm, but let's be kind. And maybe predisposes you to have a different kind of approach to the whole situation. So it could be very helpful to do loving kindness. And sometimes words are too long. I mean, the phrases are too long. And sometimes I just say, the last word of each phrase, I just say, happy, safe, healthy, peaceful, joyful, whatever the words might be. Just say those words over and over again. Sometimes I just do one word. Just happy, happy. That's enough. How's it going with practicing concentration? You finding it useful or interesting or challenging or all of the above? Yes.
At first I found the counting was overpowering my concentration on the breathing. It's up front. And I often kind of spaced out and once went up to really helped me concentrate. And today was just incredible. I did the whole thing with the breath the whole time, although I had to use different kinds of hooks to stay with it. I even began to imprint the number. Instead of saying it, I pictured it. But I stayed with it and did. I only went up to 11 three times. But I really felt what it was like to concentrate, that kind of grabbing in and not letting other things get in the way.
Great. And so, you know, you have to realize that when you take on a new practice like counting, it takes a while to learn how to do it. And to do it 3 or 4 days or even a couple of weeks. And at first it might be kind of rough and different than what you're used to. And to judge, you say, well, that doesn't work for me. It makes as much sense as, you know, not knowing how to ride a bicycle and then getting on a bicycle and falling off the first time. You say, well, this is not for me. You know, this is too hard. This is too agitating. You know, it's, you have to kind of do it for a while to get in the groove, learn the skill, and then it becomes easier and easier. And then at some point it becomes, you know, it's really easy to stay with the breath and the counting. It really becomes like second nature, just helping you stay focused and present.
In the end, would we be doing this without counting?
Some people do. It's pretty common to get instructions at a certain point you stop the counting, let go of the counting. And some people like to count, find it more useful than others. Same thing with mental noting in Vipassana. Some people find that mental noting is helpful pretty much right up until Nibbana. And some people find that they let go of the noting a lot earlier because it just gets in the way or doesn't seem helpful. So again, it really depends on the person. So for you, it's to know that it's okay to let go of it, but to, you know, at some point as the concentration gets deeper and the breath is really still, and, you know, there's very, very subtle breathing happening, and you don't feel like the mind's going to really waver from the breath at all, that, you know, you might experiment with letting go of the counting and see what happens. And then experiment with keeping the counting going. If you find the counting actually keeps you concentrated more than the opposite, keep the counting going.
I count on my fingers instead of, you know, doing the numbers, and I just relate to my fingers because I get too uptight when I actually do the numbers.
Uh-huh, interesting.
And I just wonder, you know, since I wonder, well, should I keep trying doing the numbers themselves, you know, instead? I don't know.
Well, I do know that there are people who use malas for that purpose also. And I don't know, on the fingers. You see, then you're doing two things. See, the advantage of counting is it's mental. And a lot of concentration is using that mental world to get more and more focused. And if you're using counting with your fingers...
I'm not moving them. I mean, I just, you know, my mind goes to the finger. You know,
yeah, like, your mind is split then.
So
between two physical areas, you know, between your finger and your breathing.
Right.
And, you know, I'm sure you can get pretty concentrated that way, but I think that it's going to keep you from developing that one-pointedness that needs to get locked in.
I'll try with the numbers some more.
So what happens when you do the numbers?
I just find myself, I get very uptight, just tense. I'm used to counting when for years I counted jogging, you know, and so I just associated with like counting long numbers and being very physically active.
Yeah.
And I just find I can't really relax. I just
count up to two, and then start over again. Maybe that make it easier.
I'll try.
Yeah, just count to two. Yeah.
You have said that when you lose your place when you're counting, then you should start back at one.
Yeah.
I rarely lose my place. You know, I can get up to 10 most of the time, but in between the counting, there are always thoughts. So I'm wondering, you know, when I realize that I'm not paying attention to the breath in between the actual number, should I go back to one? I probably wouldn't get past two.
You're able to count each breath, or you skip breaths in between the counts?
Oh, no, I count every breath.
Yeah, I think
counts, my mind is thinking a lot. I have found that counting the in-breath and the out-breath helps.
Oh yeah, that can help a lot. Sometimes it can help to fill the whole count with a number. So, I, for example, for a long time I counted the whole exhalation just one, two. So by filling the whole count, that kept me more connected and less likely to be thinking. The other thing that I like to do is every exhalation, if I need it, I'll not only be counting and be present for the breath, but I'll also remind myself to relax that part of my mind that thinks. So I'm letting go of my thoughts every exhalation. Every exhalation I'm letting go. Whatever has arisen, I'm letting go. And then in inhalation, something comes up. But the inhalation doesn't last that long. So that by the time I start exhaling, I let go again and let go again. And it's a very valuable massage, very, very valuable skill to just keep letting go, keep letting go. And it might be that it takes you 10,000 times of letting go to get your thinking mind to quiet down a little. But it can be, that's another approach, just let go. And let go. Just remember to let go every time you exhale. Use exhalation as a reminder to let go.
It's interesting you say that, because another thing that's been helpful, some of the time at least, is that in that space between the breaths, after I exhale, that I have tried focusing on relaxing my face, because what I've noticed is when I'm thinking, that's when I get tense, around the eyes.
Yeah.
So at the end of each breath, then that's then where I would go in between breaths.
For you, there's a gap between the exhalation and the inhalation, and that's where you'll think.
No. I don't know, it just seems like I'm really good at splitting my mind between going off in a thought, but then also being able to know where I'm at with counting in each breath, at the same time being off in a thought. So if I, at the end of each breath, what I focus on rather than some...
Touch point.
Would be just...
That's great.
The face.
That's fine.
Yeah. Sometimes.
That's a good way to help also. Now, the principle of concentration practice is the mind wants to hold. The kind of classic word is to hold, fixate. I don't know if I want to use the word fixate, but really hold something in the mind, hold something in the awareness continuously. So, I don't know if this is a good example, but if this is my belly that's breathing in and out. And, I guess the breath gets quieter and quieter, and after a while there's kind of a gap, and then, stops for a little bit, and then I breathe again. What I want to do is you want to keep your mind, keep your awareness held continuously at one place at some point. So if you're staying with the belly, you're staying with the nostrils, or wherever you feel the breath, even if the breath stops for a brief time, your mind is actually held to that place. And there might be very subtle sensations there, pressure or vibration or tautness or, I don't know what, And you just stay there, even though it doesn't seem directly connected to the breathing anymore. Just whatever the vitality or the alive feelings that are in that part of your body. So you're holding the mind in one place.
Sometimes it seems so hopeless.
Huh?
Well,
it's a practice, and it takes a long time to do,
I had the same experience when I was actually between 1 and 4. I could plan a dinner party. It might have to count one out and the bread. I was able to really split, so I kept going one, then back to one. Actually, just doing one helped a lot.
Just count to one.
One was good.
So what you want to do is you want to notice that tendency to be thinking about dinner menus or whatever, and that energy of the mind, that ability, what you want to divert that energy, or redirect energy to being with the breath rather than being with food. And you really want to... And you might have to do it over and over and over again. What you want to be on the guard of all the time is that the breathing and the counting becomes mechanical. And that's when the mind will go off and think about all kinds of stuff. And you want to always make it alive and vital and connected, and like your life energy is being poured into this thing the best you can. And so if your life energy is being poured into menu planning, just consciously, you know, let go of that or redirect it back into there, back into there. And you might even take, you know, a couple of seconds to think about the breath. You know, just in the same way that you were thinking about the dinner menu, think about the breath for a few seconds. It's kind of like when you're slipping. If you're slipping on a slippery ground, sometimes if you go with a fall, it's easier to catch yourself than if you just freeze right away. So sometimes with thoughts, you know, it's easier to kind of. Also, sometimes it's easier if you find yourself with a lot of discursive thought. At least I find sometimes, rather than immediately letting go of it, sometimes I'll actually go along with it for a few moments. And then by going along with it, it's like I really see it much more clearly. By seeing it clearly, it seems to take some of the power of it away from me. So I kind of go along with it and see it and be present for it, watch it. And then I'll let go of it. Then I'll come back to the breath. As opposed to doing that immediately. And then it's less of a hold to go back. It's less of a...
I'm not saying that it was, because, you know, I would notice and I'd say, it wasn't completely, you know, like how you said that kind of connection you described last week where you're kind of going along with it kind of right together. But it didn't feel powerful necessarily. It didn't feel like wandering off. It felt like it's all breathing, counting, thinking, breathing. I mean, it seemed to happen. Mm-hmm. So it was difficult to... it was like I could do it all at once. It felt that way.
So I mean, I wish it was just simple instructions they give you, but you know, this is how it's done, and ABC, and just follow it. But with the thoughts, there are certain thoughts that I have, their way of thinking, which is in the background or parallel tracking, whatever, which doesn't seem to get in the way of the cultivation of the concentration initially. And the best strategy for me is just to ignore it, and just as long as I feel like my life energy, my primary life energy, is focusing on the breath and being there with that, then I won't be bothered by these other thoughts, and they can do whatever they want. And at some point, though, those have to fall away. Some point, I disengage myself from those kinds of thoughts too. But I wait until the right time. If you think every time you think you're supposed to let go of it, then you might be kind of. I find that it's not so useful to certain. I don't know how to teach this. But I find that some kinds of thinking that I do, I let go of. Some thinking I do, I ignore and let it go on in the background. And it kind of settles by itself with time. And some thinking I do, I turn my attention around and do vipassana on the thinking. Unless I kind of do mindfulness and really explore the thinking, it's going to keep holding me in its grip. So depending on what's happening with my thoughts, I do different things. Now, when I'm doing concentration practice, I always have in mind, I'm doing this so that I can get back to the breath. When I do Vipassana practice, then I'm just doing it because I'm just paying attention to what's happening. But with concentration practice, I'm always thinking, I'm trying to get back to the breath. So there's a real emphasis, you know, my psyche kind of knows that's where it wants to be, that's where it wants to go. And I'm kind of like doing whatever I can to make everything else supportive of that primary mission. Yeah, please.
So when I find myself in that state of thinking and counting, I found your recommendation to shift the way that I'm counting very useful and bring me back to the breath. So if I'm staying with the exhalation and thinking, I'll count from the inhalation, or I'll count the inhalation and the exhalation together. Whatever it is, it's a way of just bringing me back to the breath. But what I found in doing this practice is that sometimes I get quiet and then I, you know, I hear a loud pitch sound or something that if I was doing Vipassana, I would just go right to it and stay with it. And so it's an effort not to rest in that and to come back to the breath. And so the question is when you do the concentration practice, is it skillful to ignore the sound and stay with the breath, or?
Yeah, generally what you're doing is ignoring everything else but your object of concentration. But sometimes you need to, if something's really pulling you away a lot, then you might need to turn towards it for a while. You need to acknowledge it, maybe do some Vipassana with it, so that it can settle, be more settled. And unless you do that, it can be very hard to stay focused on the breath, or you need to keep concentrating. Other times, I find that I just kind of throw myself back more fully in the breathing. And one of the ways I do that is I become more interested in the breath, see if I can discover something new about it.
So when I've had this experience, I've used the technique of shifting the way that I count the breaths, even for that, although I don't consider that discursive thinking. It's a different kind of an experience, but still coming back to the breath by, you know, shifting back and forth is really useful. It helps keep me right there.
So now the question for all of you is, in what ways have you found this helpful so far? A couple of weeks of concentration practice. Helpful, or how? What way are you finding it helpful or enjoyable? In what way?
Well, I noticed that with more practice in the concentration, then during the day, I experience moments where, whether it's at work or actually today it was on the bike, you know, the stationary bike, where suddenly I'm riding the bike, but then I'm focusing. I could pretty, I guess quickly, or just maybe because of the tendency of doing the practice, focus on my breath while I was doing the bike versus, you know, maybe my mind was going elsewhere. And I noticed that at work too, where I'd be doing some work with projects, and so the mind's kind of has more of a central focus, and it's easier to concentrate. And that's how it feels in my head, the same when I try to do the memorizing of the Metta Sutta. So I'm just curious if that's part of the increase in practice, if that's the result of it.
Oh, the question is her increased ability to focus in daily life a result of doing the concentration practice? I would hope it is. It could be. I mean, a lot of people report that. I find that's true for myself. The more I do concentration practice, the more my mind, the less my mind is fragmented, and the more it's kind of contented in a certain way. And if it's more less fragmented and more contented, it's a lot easier for me to be focused in one activity, what I'm doing. Yes.
Sharpens letting go, makes letting go a lot easier. Because when you're concentrating, you're not hanging out with a thought or feeling, and immediately going back to the breath, it's easier to let go. So that's one thing. It also sharpens the Vipassana. So like you get after like 3 days on a retreat, you just notice things real quick. That's because of the concentration constant, let things go. So I found that as much easier to be mindful
of the pillow. Mm-hmm. I was actually really surprised in memorizing the Metta Sutta, which I had a little bit of resistance at first, and I would get to like a certain part of it, you know, the radiating kindness, and I just every time I go to that part, I just go completely still. I mean, it really surprised me how concentrated I got doing that. And I just hang out there and wouldn't finish it. And got very, you know, after a while I realized I was getting very attached to that. And so kind of made myself, you know, do the rest. But I didn't think I could get that concentrated by doing that. That was a real surprise.
Yeah,
Audrey.
Well, I found it directly related to my reading because I can read and drift off and plan a dinner. And I was aware of that when it was starting to happen, and I could just kind of jump right in and kind of grab into what I was doing. That was very helpful.
Great. So being aware of what's happening and then being able to choose what you want to do and kind of have some strength in that choice. Smita.
Oh, I noticed most of the positive things other people mentioned. I noticed a couple of other things that were a little disconcerting. One is not being able to sleep or waking up in the middle of the night and then not able to sleep for 2, 3, 4 hours and I'm just exhausted. And secondly, if I like, so trying to take a nap during the day because I'm gonna make up for the lack of sleep. And I noticed instead of sleeping, I'm entering a meditative state. So I'm not trying to, I'm not saying anything, I'm just letting my mind wander like it does when you're napping. But there's a loud sound, so you feel, you know, the warmth coming through your body, and you're not aware of different things in your body moving. And there's a sound, you get the vibrations, you know. So that I found kind of unusual. But I don't know if it's because of concentration practice.
It could. In terms of a sleeping thing, some people will find that that concentration practice has an effect on their sleep. Sometimes it makes them sleep much better. That's more common, especially in daily life kind of sit where you sit maybe an hour or 45 minutes or something. And some people find the opposite happens, that it disturbs their sleeps in some way. Sometimes people will avoid meditating before going to sleep because it keeps them revved up. Meditation in general has a function also of taking off the surface lids of our minds, so the deeper stuff that's bubbling can bubble up, and sometimes, you know, unconscious material is bubbling up, and that's why people have trouble sleeping. Sometimes people need less sleep when they do concentration practice. As I find that true for myself, that I'll sleep less when I do a lot of concentration practice, and I mean, even like I remember when I was working on my dissertation, for example, or doing a lot of very focused, even intellectual work like that, you know, typing in the computer, I'd be very concentrated, and my sleep need decreased during those times. Yeah.
I was at a seminar this weekend that was probably long hours, a weekend long, and being present for what was being said, my concentration was pretty strong. I was also very, very conscious when my mind would start to wander and start missing what was being said and very conscious of that and pull myself right back. So that was something that I felt was a level of awareness from the presence for what was being said that I'm not sure I really had before.
Beautiful.
I also wanted to just take a second to say that I agreed to do the 45 minutes a day in this so Saturday and Sunday I did it in my samadhi practice. And Monday I found it actually a lot more difficult to keep my concentration. So
because you skipped it on the weekend.
Yeah. So I skipped it on the weekend and on Monday I got back into it and found it actually a lot more difficult. Like I felt like I'd lost some ground and just the continuity check.
Yeah, exactly. The continuity is so important to keep momentum going. Good. So you're absolved. or more importantly, you learned the lesson for yourself. And that was really valuable, I think, that you learned that. And maybe next time you... I know some people who some people who are committed to... Well, sometimes I do this, you know, that some days I haven't sat yet, and the evening comes around, and I say, I can't sit. So I'll just get in the posture. And I'll get on my cushion and sit down, and then I'm here, you know. Oh, it's so nice, and you know, I don't need to, you know, whatever was, I need to do that was so important. You know, I can sit there for 5 minutes. And, you know, I might probably sit here for 5 more minutes, and yeah. So you know, I always commit myself. I always, you know, try to at least get in the posture.
So I feel quite grounded from this practice more than I've ever felt, and in a funny way, it gives me a sense of strength that's not very familiar to me. And in some deep way, a sense of happiness and joy that's also new.
Beautiful.
So it's been really lovely.
So the concentration practice that helped Robert give him a sense of strength and a sense of happiness. And that's certainly part of the function. And that sense of strength, the inner strength that comes from concentration, really helpful as you go about your daily life. You kind of carry with you a sense of strength, of power or stability, or can make a big difference. Yes. Yeah. The strength of the concentration depends on a lot of different factors. And when you're tired, when the mind or body is tired, there's less access to any strong concentration. What's important in terms of the continuity of the practice is not necessarily that you're always at the peak level of your performance. What's important is every day you're doing the best you can to strengthen the concentration that's there. And it's that continuity of your best effort which will bear fruit. So if you sit down and you're tired, if you're giving it your best effort, and you know your concentration is not very good right now, but your best effort, that really counts. That makes a difference. If it really seems hopeless, then you might want to get up and do walking meditation. You know, if you feel like it's really hopeless, you sit down and you go into dream states, you know, you just can hardly, you know, you try to focus. Sometimes late evenings, and if I sit and I get kind of calm but relaxed, but I can't seem to concentrate. I think I can concentrate on my breath. I think I'm there with each breath, but then I realize that each breath is a whole theater of different people and characters and talking to each other, and somehow there's the whole amazing mental theater that I've created of these different people talking and acting. It's somehow coordinated with the breathing, so I think I'm with the breathing, but it just, you know, I'm really in this fantasy land. And I remember there were times when I was slow to catch on because I thought I was with the breath, and really I was just, you know, sometimes in that kind of state I find it's better to get up and do walking meditation.
Can you do the concentration, or are you just counting the steps?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. You can count the same way, 1 to 10. There's one Burmese way of counting, which is kind of nice, which helps some people keep more of the focus, is you count 1 to 5, and then you start again, and you go to 1 to 6, then 1 to 7, and you go up to 10. When you get to 10, you start counting backwards, so 1 to 10, 1 to 9, 1 to 8, back to 5, and then you start up again. And that's one way. Yes?
One of the signs of access concentration is when the breath becomes very, very refined and almost imperceptible. Are there other signs?
Well, the primary one is that the hindrances are no longer. The definition of access concentration is that the hindrances are no longer bothering a person. The hindrances are settled or quieted down. The mind is no longer going to be pulled off into desire or ill will or the other hindrances.
I've after the access has happened, before they're not here.
Yeah, in access concentration, one of the signs is the absence of the hindrances.
Yeah, and that's a lagging indicator that the access comes first.
Yeah.
And then there is the awareness that there are no hindrances, but that there's a trigger, if you will, which is the access concentration.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's. I was going to talk a little bit about the access concentration during the class today, but your question reminds me that, and kind of a little bit chastises myself because I was going to just tell you what it was, but now I'm reminded that there's different theories or different schools even of what what qualifies as access concentration. So there's the room for interpretation here, you know, in terms of defining some, using this category to define a particular state. But classically, it's defined by the absence of the hindrances. But it's also defined by the presence of a certain one-pointedness. It's relatively easy to stay focused on what you want to stay focused on. When you're doing concentration practice, it means you don't groove, and you can have to stay with your object of your concentration. If you're doing vipassana, then the mind doesn't have to be in a groove on one thing when you're doing vipassana, but rather the mind is quite wieldy or pliable. You can actually take the mind and apply it to whatever it is seems the needed object of attention at the given time. And you actually have a lot of choice in the matter there. You can keep it there as long as it seems appropriate or as needed. So what you do with the mind is different if you're doing concentration practice as you're doing vipassana practice, and both practices can be done in access concentration. And I don't know how important it is to have a careful definition or signs of what it might be, but I think the hindrances are no longer feel like mind's going to be pulled away from anything. One of the ways I characterize it for myself is I have like a rubber band attached to my awareness, and as I get stronger and stronger concentrated, my mind still might start going off, but I don't have to make any effort to come back. It's like a rubber band is attached, and it just pulls me right back. And sometimes, as the concentration gets stronger, there's a shorter and shorter tether, for the mind to wander away. Just that's what the mind wants to stay, and goes away, and goes away. And then at some point, any tendency to go away seems to fall away. And it's relatively easy to apply myself and stay present. And as you said, the breath at that point is usually very still and very quiet. And the body, some of the jhanic factors can begin to appear in various ways. They might not be very intense. So there might be, some people have the signs of joy or happiness or feeling of well-being and contentment. For me, I take it as now the mind has the ability to get locked on. Or is it grooved on, or settled, or fixated, or just can be worked there? And there's no real tendency to wander away. So the hindrances are not an issue then. It's kind of a contentment in the mind also. It isn't so much of the. For me, it comes a point where the hindrances are no longer an issue, not because they don't appear anymore, not because they still appear and I'm not interested in them. There's simply not an interest in sensual gratification or interest in being angry with someone or something.
In what you describe about seeing the shorter tether and seeing the mind begin to wander and bringing it back, I've experienced that. And on retreat, what seems to happen is that at some point I realize that movement, or the way I have been dealing with it on retreat, actually, at some point I see that movement back is actually effort, and that there's kind of an inclination to let the mind do what it wants to do, which is to wander, but to stay present for what it wants to do. Uh-huh. I find that when I do that, I keep like almost settling deeper and deeper. Yeah. So I don't know how that relates, but it was kind of a wonderful gift to see that I could notice the wandering or notice the tendency of the mind to let go of what it was paying attention to, mm-hmm. but still keep the awareness with the mind as it did what it wanted to do.
Beautiful. That's a little bit more of the vipassana, where you're open to whatever is going on. And
so, if I wanted to cultivate the concentration, I would go ahead and keep coming back.
Not necessarily. I mean, the vipassana can be support concentration also, as long as you know you're settling something, relaxing. If you're always wandering around, then I don't know. But I don't know if this is true, but I've been told by some of my teachers that if all you did was practice letting go, you'd enter into the jhanas. So, so if you're doing what you're doing and just kind of taking anything that comes up and just letting go and let go of it, makes sense to me that you get more and more settled and perhaps you would get into a deeply concentrated state that way.
I have a period probably about 10 minutes in when I suddenly get like a flush of feeling totally relaxed and my skin changes. I can feel it. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, sure. Maybe you should all sit a little bit closer. I don't know how many people more are coming, but in a little while we'll sit, and it'd be nice for latecomers to find place.
Are we taking a break?
Oh, would you like to take a short break, those of you who've been here for an hour?
Good.
Okay, please, come. So I thought we would start first with someone reciting the Metta Sutta, and then we do a sitting, or we can start with a sitting and someone can volunteer to recite the Metta Sutta into our sitting as we begin our sitting. So would someone like to volunteer today? Laura? Okay. So why don't we all just sit and close your eyes, and after a couple of moments, when Laura feels ready, she can start in.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in their speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety may all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none. The great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
As you continue with this sitting, begin by having goodwill towards yourself. Begin by extending some loving kindness to yourself sitting here in this body and mind at this time. Feeling yourself, feeling your body and mind, how you are. having whatever thoughts you want of goodwill, of kindness, having whatever feeling or attitude of kindness, intention of kindness, that might be easy to bring up. Tender, gentle kindness for yourself. And then in a few moments we'll begin with the breathing, being with the breath. And one of the traps of concentration practice is conceit. Is to feel like you're the one who's going to do it. Kind of excessive self-direction and self-doings, powering oneself into being concentrated. Where it's all about you, and about self. I think it's helpful in doing concentration practice for there to be a little bit of a humility. About what you're about to undertake. That's not really all about you and how well you do and the self. You're going to apply yourself the best you can. But it's not a battle of the self. Different part of you, different part of who you are than your self-image, which engages in the practice. You might now begin with your breathing and take a few long, slow, deep breaths to connect to your breathing. And as you exhale, to relax your body and your mind. And then letting your breath return to normal. And take some time now to familiarize yourself with how your breathing, your natural breathing, happens to be right now. No two breaths are ever the same. The pattern of breathing changes from day to day and situation to situation. How is it now for you? As you're feeling your breathing, can you adjust it in any way so that it becomes more comfortable, more pleasant, by relaxing perhaps some of the muscles connected to breathing, the stomach muscles or the chest, shoulders, or by ever so slightly breathing maybe more fully into some part of your body? Perhaps it feels nice to breathe into the tension that you might be holding in some part of your body, your shoulders or your chest or your belly. What is the length of in-breath and out-breath that feels most easy for you, most comfortable? Take a few moments to notice what effect your breathing has on the rest of your body, kind of just beyond the boundaries of where you usually feel the breathing. Does it have a calming effect or tensing effect or relaxing? Usually there's some part of the cycle of breathing which is less clear than other parts. Some people find the exhalation is less clear than the inhalation, or parts of the exhalation, the end of it perhaps, or it can be almost anywhere, but notice if the sense of connection or the sense of clarity around the breath varies as you go through the cycle. And then remind yourself or give yourself a little more emphasis so that you can have full connection to the whole cycle. Stay connected with your breathing. Hang in there with it. Hold on to it. When there's other sounds that might pull you away, give yourself a little bit extra emphasis. And then whatever place in your body you feel the breathing most clearly, the abdomen, or the solar plexus, or the chest, or the throat, or the nose, wherever it happens to be clearest, focus in on that part. Hone in on it. Let that part of your breathing, that part of your body, be the place that massages your concentration, that develops your focus. Hang in there. Don't let the mind wander away from that part. In the background, you might have thoughts or reactions or changes in your body of all kinds. Whatever happens, just keep being devoted to the breath. Hang in there. And then you can begin counting if you haven't already. Letting the counting help sustain the attention over time. Letting each count also help you, remind you to let go of anything else that detracts you from just hanging in there with the breathing. As you stay with your breathing, relax your mind. Let your mind become soft, expansive, so that the experience of breathing, the sensations of breathing, enters into an expansive mind. So the concentration is very intent, very connected with the breathing, but the awareness of the concentration at the same time is expansive. Relaxed. If there's anything pleasurable about your breathing as you stay with it, anything even modicum of enjoyment in it, or easeful or nice, use that as the grounding, the anchor for being with the breath. So you're there with something pleasant, enjoyable. You're allowed to enjoy when you do concentration practice. The enjoyment can actually pull you in to be more concentrated if you go with it. As you continue with the counting, learn to vary the way that you count. One way is to vary the intensity or the firmness by which you make the count. If need be, you can be firmer. And like each count is like putting down a stake or a kind of grounding yourself firmly into the breath. Or sometimes what's needed is to let the counting become very subtle, very soft, a wisp in the mind. Sometimes it's helpful to have a feeling or a sense of the stillness that surrounds or penetrates the breath, the stillness of the body or the room, the stillness that surrounds or penetrates awareness or concentration itself. Somehow appreciating the context of stillness for the movement of the breathing can help the mind become stiller, more absorbed, just breathing. So on one hand there can be stillness, and at the same time there can also be a arousing of vitality, of energy, of chi or prana as you sit here. And you might notice as you continue concentrating on the breath, notice the arousing factor, the energized factor of engagement or aliveness. See if there's something more engaging or an active part of being concentrated. Maybe it's an activity that you participate in almost naturally. You join together with the vitality of your body to be more focused on the breath, to be more engaged. It's almost as if the vitality of your body joins in the effort to be concentrated on the breath. And then in the last 2 or 3 minutes of the sitting, give yourself over to each breath. Don't miss a breath. Have a great commitment to the breathing, to being concentrated. Whatever it takes, you hold on, you break into a sweat if need be. Just don't let yourself miss one breath. But try to stay relaxed too. So this evening I wanted to talk a little bit about the obstacles to concentration, and certainly to let you know that it's not a smooth path, and that many of you sooner or later, probably sooner is the chance, will be dealing with the obstacles to concentration, that which gets in the way and makes it difficult. And I wanted to say first that I think it's helpful to think of meditation as a journey, as a place, instead of as a place. Or it's an activity, it's something we do, as opposed to something we just kind of a natural state. There's a very strong tendency for many of us to want to kind of rest in a natural state. There are Buddhist teachings that tell us to do that. And think of concentration as kind of a natural state we fall into, perhaps. But concentration is an activity of the mind. Something the mind does. The mind is made up of a lot of activities. That's all it is. And concentration isn't one kind of activity. It can be a very refined activity. It's still an activity. And because it's an activity of the mind, in the farther reaches of the Buddhist path, it's also an activity you have to let go of. But you don't have to let go of it before you're ready to let go of it. So you have to kind of develop it before you can let go of it. So, if you're learning how to ride a bicycle and use training wheels, you don't let go of the training wheels until you've developed a certain level of skill of riding the bicycle. Then you try without the wheels, training wheels. But think of meditation as a journey and not a state. as you're always on this journey, you're traveling, you're on a path, you're going somewhere. If you're pretty intent to walk from here to Yosemite, there'll be parts of the trip which is relatively easy and parts which are difficult and strenuous. But you know that in order to get to Yosemite, you have to put your foot in front of you, take the next step and the next step. And if it's really hard one day and you have blisters and it's really steep, you know that you have to make those steps. You have to continue. You're going to keep walking all the way. If you thought that Yosemite was a state that's right here and now, then you might not remember to take the next step. Concentration practice is best thought of as a journey. And don't let any of the difficulties that arise be an excuse not to take the next step. It's always the continuity that's important. And you can expect there'll be times when it's difficult and times that it's easy. Sometimes it's inherent with the process of meditation, and sometimes because of external conditions have conspired to make our life difficult and steer us up. And just to, I just gotta keep stay on that journey. What's important is to keep walking and keep walking. So you don't give up just because it's hard. Sooner or later it will be hard. So you can expect difficulties, and then the question is, how do you relate to them? And how do you work with them, is the question. You know, classically, Buddhism is not considered an ism, but rather is considered to be a path. And the image of a path is nice, because a path in the forest is a place where the forest, the vines and the bushes and the shrubbery and the trees and the branches, have been cut away so that you can be unobstructed as you walk along the forest. The path is a clearing. Things have been made clear. And the Buddhist path is something we create as we go along in the forest of our lives. And one of the things we're doing, learning to do, especially in concentration practice, is how to open up that forest, the jungle thicket, so we have a clear path. But each of us follows our own path, and sooner or later you run into obstacles. You have to learn how to work with it or clear the path for yourself. Concentration practice besides all the normal kind of things that can get in the way of concentration, but obstacles and difficulties, concentration practice itself sometimes kicks up a lot of hindrances. Sometimes a more psychological interpretation of what happens is that the surface kind of lid of the mind, the conscious kind of lid that we kind of normally engage in, settles down, and the deeper stuff that's in the unconscious or repressed or suppressed has a chance to finally surface, and we have to deal with it. Sometimes concentration practice, because it's a kind of a suppression practice, kind of like focusing on one thing and exclusion of other things, we're excluding from awareness things that really need attention sometimes. And sometimes they come back with a great force. And so sometimes concentration practice will elicit a greater counter-reaction. And sometimes it can be quite unfortunate, very, very powerful, if you don't have a wise approach to doing concentration practice. Sometimes as the mind gets more and more concentrated, it seems to be able to pick up certain themes or issues which maybe you always knew about, but suddenly you see them in greater clarity, or somehow the concentration focuses on them, and suddenly they loom really big. And it's not until you settle these issues can you really continue with the path. So right now I'm remembering the story John Travis tells of practicing in India in the 60s. And at some point, you know, he practiced very well. He had deep practice. And at some point, he kind of wasn't going very much further in his practice. He was troubled by something. And he went to Ram Dass, who he knew in India at that time. And Ram Dass said, "Oh, you have to go back to Kentucky and see your father." And here, he was in India. So he went all the way back to Kentucky and bought himself, he was a long-haired, wandering sadhu, and he bought himself a suit and a tie to go see his father and kind of work out his relationship with his father. And once that was a little bit worked out, then he went back to India and continued being a sadhu. So certain things kind of appear as we continue that are better dealt with outside the context of meditation practice itself even. And you have to know when to do that, not to try to make your meditation being solution to everything. I've seen a couple of times, not a lot of times, situations where I felt actually sad when someone said, I'm going to work out my difficulties in my life through meditation. And in that particular, those two people I'm thinking about, it was really sad. They really needed a lot of other help. They were really doing terrible things in the world and harming other people. And they knew it. I'm just going to deal with it in my meditation. I'm going to go off in the cave someplace and deal with it. Sometimes you need to deal with the obstacles in other ways besides on the cushion or just kind of toughing it out or powering through. When people first begin a meditation practice, concentration practice, some people have the experience of what maybe flippantly could be called beginner's luck. And, you know, there's a great aura of this great religious practice, this great religion you're involved in, and it's so fascinating, it has such great hope and promise, and you now you're doing the same practice as the Dalai Lama, and it's just, you know, really, you know, you sit down to meditate and just really, you know, it's just like, wow, and you know, you get concentrated really quickly because of that beginner's kind of enthusiasm. And after a while, that fades away, and then you're left with yourself. And that's actually considered a very good place to be in Buddhism, be left with yourself, and no longer have the Dalai Lama along with you. But then it can be a lot more difficult. Suddenly, all the different you know, hindrances and attachments and fears that you have flood yourself once that initial kind of beginner's luck falls away. So you have to not to get discouraged and feel like it's hopeless. And say, oh, now it's really beginning. That was just kind of a nice foretaste of something wonderful to come, perhaps. That first, you know, beginning sitting, but now I have to really face myself. Has anybody had that experience? It's kind of nice to begin. It was really great to begin with, and then it was about you. So to know all this, to know that difficulties are part of the path, and to actually, in a kind of way, be welcoming to the difficulties. Not welcoming in that you're looking for them and saying, you know, inviting them in, you know, but rather, you know, when they do appear, when they invite themselves in, that you're actually very welcoming. So, oh, this is part of the path too. That this is actually healthy to consider the path to include these difficulties. And then the question is, how do you work with them? How do you face them? Now, there are different strategies of how to work with the so-called difficulties if you're doing Vipassana, and different ones if you're doing more concentration practice. And some of it I think I talked about last week, and some of it maybe is obvious to you, and some of it we'll talk about today. I wanted to give you an overview first of, in the Buddhist tradition, and even just the Pali, the Theravadan tradition, there's a wide range of kinds of concentration that's talked about. And there's a lot of different lists and categories of concentration, states of concentration. And there's one list, kind of a list, it's kind of a pseudo list, it doesn't appear anywhere in the suttas, of four different categories of concentration. The first is not a category of concentration. First is our street consciousness, kind of the way our street consciousness, the way our mind just usually is, you know, kind of busy after a busy day, or kind of just as your mind that's untrained, undeveloped, just kind of our mind as it is. The first stage of concentration is called preparatory concentration, parikamma samadhi, preparatory concentration. The second stage in this system is called access concentration. The third, preparatory concentration is when you have to apply yourself and really work. You have to work with the hindrances, with the difficulties. You have to work with the mind's tendency to be fragmented and be distracted. And you have to find out some wise way of dealing with the kind of street consciousness, street mind that you have, and work with it and learn strength of letting go, do all the things that are needed to prepare and develop the garden of the mind so that the seed of concentration can really go far. So there's a lot of things you might do in preparation. You might develop your faith, as I talked about Monday night a little bit. You might develop your morality. You might find things that inspire you. You might develop a strength of letting go. You might develop a strength of concentration, of applying yourself, strength of application. No matter what happens, you can apply yourself. try to live a calm life. You do all kinds of things in preparation for developing concentration. In concentration practice itself, there's sometimes a kind of feeling of manual labor that goes into just kind of plug away. And sometimes there's nothing else you can do but just plug away. Even people who are really adept meditators sometimes will find themselves in situations where they just got to plug away, you know, just manual labor, you know, just brute, you know, I don't know if brute force is the right word, but you just got to just, you know, just feels like you're just Prometheus, you know. Was that Prometheus, the right myth? You know, pushing the rock up the hill, is that right?
Sisyphus.
Thank you. He's like, you know, just, you know, pushing that, you know, it seems hopeless. Just do it and do it and do it. And maybe you have enough experience, you know, that just eventually something kicks in and begins taking, you know, takes over the concentration, the samadhi factors begin kicking in. But just, you know, brute labor, you know, just manual labor. And someone who doesn't know anything else, say, why are you doing this? You know, this is so boring. And sometimes it's really boring, that level of practice, preparatory practice. So the preparatory concentration is that level of application, just doing it before any of the samadhi factors come into place. Any of the other factors, supporting factors, kind of, they're kind of lift you up and kind of keep the concentration kind of buoyant and alive in itself. Sometimes in the kind of preparatory stage, this image that I mentioned earlier of tethering the mind is used. Sometimes the analogy is tethering a horse, a wild horse. If you take a wild horse and you just, you know, you take a really strong stake and you dig it really deep into the ground and you tie a rope to it and tie a rope to the horse, and then the horse will just go wild and run around and kind of jump and do whatever it can, trying to get free. But eventually it calms down and realizes it gives up and realizes it can't get away. And eventually the horse becomes more and more tamed, more and more tameable. And sometimes the mind is that way. You have to tether the mind. And so you have to do that work of just kind of, okay, I'm going to hold my mind here. I'm going to do the work, just hold my mind here, until the wild monkey mind begins to quiet down, calm down. And sometimes that works really well. Eventually the mind gives up. The mind will give up a good fight, but eventually sometimes the mind quiets down. Sometimes the preparatory level, you need to do something else. You need to do vipassana practice. You need to bring mindfulness to bear and really understand what some of the forces of the mind are so you can settle them. I like to say, a little bit again, simplistically, that there are three ways of concentrating the mind. One is through the effort of applying the mind to get concentrated, through an act of will, in a sense, which is what samadhi practice is basically about. The second is by letting go of all the things that keep you from being concentrated. And that's a little bit more vipassana practice, where you actually, things arise, and you bring your attention to there, and you settle them, you take care of them, and then eventually you take care of all the things that keep you from being settled and relaxed and concentrated. And the third way to get concentrated is by accident. Right. By accident. You know, you had this wonderful lunch, and you did a great hike up Windy Hill, and the grass is really green, and you find a nice shade under the tree, and you have a nice nap, and you wake up from your nap, and you feel so calm and concentrated, just so present, you know, with that hawk that's circling above you, just right there, you're not leaving. You're not doing it, you know, and you congratulate yourself for being really concentrated. It's just, you know, all these different causes and conditions have come together to let the mind be settled and concentrated, but there's no strength there, no development of the mind. It's just kind of an accident, just causes and conditions coming together. So sometimes you need to do more vipassana practice to learn to let go or settle issues. And sometimes you need to just kind of apply yourself more diligently and do the manual work of staying focused on the breath. So that's kind of we learn to work with the hindrances. We learn to work with the difficulties. I'll talk more about that in a few minutes. We'll learn why strategies, how to deal particularly with things. Like bring in the antidotes. So if you're filled with lust, sexual desire, then the classic antidote is to think about or visualize, contemplate what's called the unbeautiful parts of the body. Sometimes it's translated in English as the foul parts of the body. The word is asobha. Asobha is beautiful. So it's the unbeautiful. So I'll let you decide. you know, it's kind of almost politically incorrect for me to say that some part of the body is unbeautiful. But you can decide which is the unbeautiful parts. And so you sit there, you know, you're filled with sexual desire for someone, and your mind keeps going there. You just start visualizing the unbeautiful parts of their body. And pretty soon, you know, they say the sexual desire settles away. And so using antidote, in other words, it isn't that the Buddhism says the body is foul. It's saying, you know, this is a good antidote, certain times, to be used when you're, you know, really caught up in some place you don't want to be caught up in. Then there's the upachara samadhi, which is access concentration. And access concentration, sometimes it's called neighborhood concentration. And I think because it's the access to being to different realm of states of mind, or you're in the neighborhood of deeper realms of concentration, deeper realms of practice. And in access concentration, your thought and your thinking and what's called the hindrances are no longer getting in the way of you being concentrated. There might still be thinking going on, but and there might still be desire that arises a little bit, but they're not going to hinder you anymore. You now, the mind is able to stay on track. You know how to, you can apply the mind, you can stay on track. You really have the feeling that, oh, I'm on track and I can stay on track here. I can be focused, I can be engaged. The mind is usually feeling quite pliant, quite light, quite open, relaxed at this point. Also very vitalized and alive. Often there's can be a feeling of joy and vitality. At the same time, of great stillness. Sometimes the breath gets very quiet and calm at this point, very subtle. But the primary characteristic of access concentration is the hindrances are no longer hindering. And so there's a lot of emphasis then in Buddhist meditation practice to learn to work with the hindrances. And the hindrances are, many of you know them, those of you who have done more than 3 retreats, if you have Vipassana retreats, you should have these memorized. If you don't have them memorized, get to work. You should know these really, you know, you should be able to smell them, you know, from a distance. It's coming. You know, you should know, you're so familiar with them, you need to be connoisseurs of the hindrances. Rather than thinking of them as being problems and, oh my God, the anger and ill will has arisen again, you're supposed to say, great, I'm supposed to be a connoisseur. I'm supposed to know them so well I can write a dissertation on these 5. So you really know them well and you're familiar with them so they lose their power over you. That's one of the strategies. So it's desire for sensual gratification is the first. That can be a hindrance if you're really caught up in wanting sensual gratification. There's nothing wrong with that in and of itself, but the desire for it, the questing for it, the craving for it, it keeps the mind from getting concentrated because you're so focused on the object of wanting that thing. Sometimes it's very dramatically, it's nothing to do with meditation at all, and it keeps your mind imagining the most wonderful vacation you can think of having. And you're just obsessing on that sensual gratification of laying on that beach in Tahiti. Or sometimes it has to do with wanting sensual gratification in meditation itself. Sometimes that gets in the way because it's not happening and you want it or you're imagining it or whatever. The second is ill will, is to have some kind of ill will towards someone or something. You're meanly disposed. You're judgmental, critical, angry, spiteful, hateful, some kind of ill will involved to what's happening. Both desire and ill will have an object for their focus. It's the thing out there we're focusing on. And that keeps us from entering into this deep subjective intimacy with the object of concentration. There's an object of concentration usually, like the breath or something else, but we want a deep subjective intimacy with that object of concentration. And sometimes it's said that in very deep states of concentration, the subject-object distinction falls away. But until it does, You want to bring a very deep subjective engagement in what's happening. As long as you're focusing on an object, like, you know, she did that to me, or that vacation, or that thing, the mind is pulled away from this deep subjective immersion with the object. So the subjective aspect of what's happening is very important if you want to get concentrated. Being aware of it, sensing it, entering into the subjective world, letting the subjective world be there with the object. So desire, ill will, sloth and torpor is the third hindrance, restlessness and anxiety, and doubt. And each of those has an antidote. Actually, there's a lot of different antidotes for different, number of ones we can use for different ones. Mostly as a Vipassana teacher, I've been very reluctant to teach people antidotes. I kind of don't believe in them for the purposes of Vipassana, because I'm kind of a Vipassana purist in that mode. You just deal with it with your mindfulness practice. You see, if you have a hindrance, just bring your full mindfulness to that hindrance. Don't try to get rid of it. Just enter it. Make that the field of your practice through mindfulness. Let mindfulness work it out. When you do concentration practice, having an antidote can be very helpful, because you don't have to work out your hindrances to get concentrated. You just have to have them, you know, in the basement or out of the way, you know, or kind of not bothering you, or just kind of settled for the time being, or balanced by the antidote. So in the access concentration, there's a feeling that the state of the mind state, has been altered or changed. Maybe altered is not a good word, because altered has the idea of kind of extra special or something. But the mind has become pliable, light, settled, concentrated, engaged, workable. It's usable now. You can start using the mind. You can apply it in some way. This is a word I like. The mind is starting to become independent. Your ability to be aware or focused or attentive has become independent of all the different things that pulls you away. You're no longer thinking about dinner or thinking about vacations or thinking about sensual gratification. You're no longer pulled attached to those. The mind has detached itself from those kind of concerns. So the mind has become independent. And that independence then gives the mind the ability to be then more, to apply itself more fully, to be more honed or more, you know, becomes more usable, because now it's independent. It's not going to be hijacked. So after upachara samadhi, after this access concentration, there's a fork in the road. And it said that a person can choose one of the two forks. Sometimes our mind chooses for us. If a mind has a very strong bent towards concentration, it'll tend to choose to go further in concentration mode, which is one of the forks, go into deeper states of concentration. Or you can go the different fork, which is the fork of vipassana. And vipassana is not synonymous with mindfulness. Vipassana is mindfulness that's coupled with a very strong concentration. So when you have this access concentration level, that's when really you begin seriously follow the opportunity of getting into real the vipassana stages themselves. Or you go into the deeper concentration state. The deeper concentration state is called, at this point is called apana samadhi, or full samadhi, full concentration. So there's preparatory concentration, there's access concentration, then there's full concentration, which has to do with the eight jhanas. Maybe we'll talk about those some next week. If you take the vipassana route fork, then you have a samadhi that's called kanika samadhi. And kanika samadhi is translated into English as momentary samadhi. And this is a samadhi, a concentration, where the mind is not focused on one particular thing. It's not locked in or honed or, you know, focused one pointedly on one thing. But rather, it's completely concentrated to what's happening in the present moment. The mind is not going to leave the present moment for anything. But whatever arises in the present moment, it's there choicelessly to attend, to meet whatever arises. There's a sound, and the mind is able to really be there for that sound. It's not going to wander off into discursive thought or ideas or fantasy, just there for that. There's an itch, then you go there really for itch. The breath arises, you're really there. And that momentary really staying there and penetrating what arises in the moment without needing to be fixed on it is what's called Kanika Samadhi, which is really the samadhi, the kind of concentration. It's called a samadhi that is part of Vipassana practice. So Vipassana also involves entering into a samadhi. It's a different kind of samadhi than full concentration, which is the jhanas. Questions for that? Yes?
Are you talking about the course within one meditation session?
Oh, no.
You're lucky.
Very lucky if you could do that. I mean, some people are quite adept at this, and they could certainly do that in a session of meditation. But for most people, this is, this is what happens in the long term. So like if you go on a 10-day retreat, there'll be times, probably, where you enter into access concentration. It's relatively common for people to enter into access concentration, but to go beyond that is not so common. And usually in a 10-day retreat, it might not be very long. It's, a period or two here or there, or the third or fourth day, maybe someone really feels like they have that usable, independent awareness. It can feel really great when people enter into it. And sometimes in daily practice it happens, the momentum builds over time in daily practice, and you can feel, you can enter into this access concentration. And as a person, it's a skill we're developing. And as the skills become more and more developed, the person can get more skill and can drop in much more quickly. Well, if you just continued whatever you're doing, whatever you're already doing to get you into access concentration, chances are you'll do one or the other. But you could also choose, and some people will do a concentration practice to bring themselves to access concentration, or bring themselves to the first jhana or second or whatever they feel is useful, and then they'll let go of the concentration practice and then do more vipassana. In the Mahasi system, which I'm in, access concentration is the place we do vipassana practice from. That's where the fork splits. So, or a teacher might tell you. Your teacher might tell you, you should be working more on concentration. This is good for you. Or might say, stop doing this concentration stuff. And then they might say something derogatory about concentration. It's child's play, They'll say something in order to kind of dislodge you, so you don't get not so attached. Because people get really attached to the deep concentration states, so it can be. And some people will get to stay there for years. And sometimes you need a teacher to kick them in the butt, and whatever it takes. And some people, there's all kinds of, that's a whole issue in itself.
Sequences they arise, but then come back, and then it may be actually sort of a blend of the two that I'm really hearing.
That's right. In my understanding, if it was this kind of pure vipassana instruction, it would be sit down and start paying attention to whatever's happening in the present moment in a choiceless kind of way. Most of us, when we sit down coming off the street, it's not a very useful instruction because the mind is so distracted. And so it's helpful to start grounding the mind and calm it down and develop some concentration. And so the usual way to do that is on the breath. And the breath then has this double function where it can both be a concentration focus and it can be a place we develop mindfulness. When you develop mindfulness in the breath, you really want to get in there and to see clearly all the nuances of what's going on in the breath. If you're doing concentration, you don't have to know anything about the breath. You just have to just stay with it. So when I went, but you're right. And so Some teachers focus, so like a 10-day retreat, the first two or three days will be to stay with the breath, stay with the breath, because of it has a concentrating function. And when I teach, my basic teaching, I think, is have a preference for your breath when you do Vipassana. So you really, you know, whenever you have a choice, choose the breath. But if need be, leave the breath and pay attention to what else is going on. But let there be kind of a leaning into the breath or preference for it, because it's so helpful as a place to develop concentration. And at some point, you don't need any, you can just continue developing deeper concentration with Vipassana, because if you really stay with whatever's arising, you don't need the breath anymore. But for the most part, I think it's very helpful for people.
Could you elaborate a little more on the difference of using the breath for concentration versus Vipassana? I mean, I've heard that distinction before, where Vipassana you pay attention to the nuances, and in concentration you don't really need to do that.
Right.
I understand the Vipassana side. That's the way my mind goes. I don't really understand what you mean when you say you don't really need to know what's going on when you just stay with the breath. But can you elaborate on that a little bit?
So I often feel my breath here in my belly. If I was doing concentration, I would just plant my attention here in my belly and just hang on to that part of my body as it goes up and down, up and down. Just hang in there, hang in there, hang in there.
But my mind just sort of naturally goes to the different sensations that happen in that area.
Yeah,
so
that's what your mind does.
So don't worry about trying to understand the other ones.
What?
I don't understand what.
Yeah, so different minds function different ways. There's nothing wrong about having different minds, but some minds are more have more tendency towards concentration, and some more towards insight or seeing or discerning what's there. And probably you're a more discerning type. Also, you have a strong habit now doing Vipassana, and that also, you know, probably feeds into that. Samadhi practice, concentration practice, in one way, is kind of dumb, because you don't have to learn very much about what you're focusing on. You just have to hang in there. So, you know, don't leave it. And then you use your intelligence to figure out the strategies of how best to just hang in there with that dumb thing. You know, so your mind doesn't get to wander away and doesn't get, you know. Use all your intelligence to do this really simple, basic, dumb thing. Just you know. And that's part of the reason why it really helps in concentration practice, usually, to have something very, very simple that you're doing. So the mind gets simpler and simpler and more focused on this one thing. So I don't know if is that being clear enough? Or? So I want to go back a little bit to the idea of preparatory samadhi, the preparations. I don't think maybe I said this clear enough in the beginning. Some people, it's very classic in Theravada Buddhism, when you first sit down to meditate, to actually spend some time, 5 or 10 minutes perhaps, doing some kind of preparatory meditations before doing either concentration practice or Vipassana practice. And there are 4 classic preparatory practices. One is called the recollection of the Buddha, which is to recall the qualities, the virtues, whatever you know about the Buddha, as a way of filling your mind with gladness and happiness, inspiration, delight, so that you're really kind of, you know, not thinking about dinner anymore, you know, or not thinking about your bank account as if that's really important. You're really there, you're really inspired by this, the example of the Buddha. The second is to practice metta. So loving kindness is a great toning effect for many people. It lubricates, settles us, sets in the right kind of mood or atmosphere of friendliness to our experience. And it's very helpful to have that kind of settled, friendly attitude towards ourselves and our experience as we meditate. The third one is what we talked about, asobha, which is contemplating the unbeautiful parts of the body. And I don't know, some of you might find it really helpful. You might get really grounded and settled and arrive here if you just spend some time thinking about the unbeautiful parts of the body. And, it sobers you up. And I'm sure most of you, it's not an appropriate meditation to do. But I like it, just, that metta and the unbeautiful parts are both being offered here. So you don't think that, oh, this Buddhist, you know, they're into this world-negating kind of stuff, you know, just all this. You know, Buddhism is a kind of downer, right, of a religion, unbeautiful. Buddhism has a full range of wise things that you could pick up, the tools, depending on the, you know, different medicines, depending on the condition that needs attention. And sometimes, they say, the unbeautiful is what's needed. I've actually never practiced it. So, true confession. And then the last one is Maranasati, which is recollection of death. To spend some time contemplating death, that you too will die. This is a, so each of these is often meant as an antidote for certain states. So it's pretty easy to see that unbeautiful is an antidote towards lust. Contemplation of death is maybe an antidote to anxiety or laziness or complacency. Metta is an antidote towards ill will or anger, irritation, judgmentalism. And contemplation of the Buddha, recollection of the Buddha, is an antidote to anxiety, restlessness, desire of all kinds, superficiality. Oh, skeptical doubt. Thinking about the Buddha sometimes helps overcome doubt. You're so inspired by this, you know, this figure of the Buddha, that whatever doubt you have about the practice is put to ease, and it's easier than to get focused and concentrated. Are you still with me? Yeah? I don't know, you know. It's suddenly got a little quieter in the room, and I'm talking a lot. And, you know, I don't know, maybe you're getting bored suddenly, or maybe I used up my allotted attention that you had available to you. Or are you still practicing concentration? Concentrating on my voice and what I'm saying. So, can I continue? Is that okay?
Yes.
So part of the preparatory stage then is working with the obstacles, the hindrances to concentration. Learning how to do it wisely so they become settled and no longer become a hindrance. So, as I said now a number of times, you can always use mindfulness practice. That can be very helpful. One of the hindrances we have is thoughts. And if we want to develop that independent, detached mind of mindful of concentration, we need to somehow have settled our thoughts enough that the mind is independent of our thinking. It doesn't mean we stop thinking, but the mind is no longer pulled by it or caught up by it. Pulled away. Mind can stay focused and keep doing its work. Sometimes you can have experience of the thoughts can be in the background, and you can just keep focusing on the issue at hand with the thoughts in the background. They're not in the way anymore. And that's helpful to know, because some people get obsessive about the presence of thoughts, thinking. And they think that there's some personal failure that they're thinking in meditation. Suzuki Roshi had one of the best advices about thinking, I thought. In meditation, don't be bothered by your thoughts. That's really the best way. If you trying not to think and trying not to try to think, both agitate the mind and usually conducive to more thinking. So sometimes the best strategy is ignore your thoughts, just let them do whatever they want, and stay focused on the concentration and the practice you're doing, if you can. But there's other kind of repertoire of tools to work with thoughts. And some of them I've given to you when I do the, for those of you who've taken the Intro to Mindfulness class. Sometimes just let go of them is the best thing. Sometimes saying, not now, to your thinking. Not now, I'll think about that later. Is really helpful. Sometimes the mind listens. Oh, mind knows it's going to be attended to later. It'll just relax for now, later. Sometimes just do a very firm no. Sometimes it's really, really powerful, strong. If you have a 4-year-old, and sometimes you just have to say no in a very strong way. And with no anger, no animosity, you know, just very clear, no. And sometimes that works with the mind. Sometimes the mind's like a 4-year-old. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you need to look and find out where the tension is in the face or in the skull, in the brain, or in the shoulders, the neck, that's associated with your thinking. And then relax whatever tension you can find connected to your thinking. And unless you relax the tension in your body connected to the thinking, that tension is like this little factory for thinking. Sometimes you need to really acknowledge the emotion that's connected to the thoughts. The planning mind is often connected to the anxiety. So just kind of then ground yourself in that, relax that. There's a whole bunch of different strategies you can have with thoughts. And different kinds of thinking needs different strategies when you're doing concentration practice. And so you have to find your way in that. And one of the strategies is simply to bear down on the breath. Sometimes it's appropriate. It's sometimes said, it kind of as a last resort, grit your teeth. And just, you know, hang in there. Just, you're not going to leave. Nothing else, you know, works. And just, you've tried everything else under the sun. And just, okay, hang. Grit your teeth. The main hindrances are the hindrances, which I enumerated before. And there are two sides to the hindrances and two sides to thinking. One is this: there's, in a sense, there's spontaneous appearance. Suddenly you have a desire, or you suddenly have thoughts of ill will, or you're restless. And then there's your engagement in it, you're participating in it, you're acting it out. Having a spontaneous appearance is not a problem. It's then you getting involved in it which is the problem. And if you can start seeing how you get engaged, how you get sucked in and get involved, and then stop that, let go of that, that's very helpful if you can do that. You know, if you have this, you know, it's easy to see, if you're thinking about Tahiti, a vacation in Tahiti. After a while, you notice you're thinking about it, and you're participating, you're engaging in it. You don't have to, so you let go of it. You might, 2 minutes later, have another Tahiti thought, but then you know, oh, I'm not going to pick that up, I'm not going to get involved in that. You let go of it. There's a whole series of things, classic teachings around how you can work with the hindrances. One is to consider the consequences, which means having some wisdom about the presence of the hindrances. You know, out of bitter experience, it's not very helpful to spend a whole retreat thinking about Tahiti. You paid all this money to go on retreat, you've cleared your life, you know, and you sit down to meditate in the state-of-the-art meditation center, and you know, what in the world are you doing thinking about Tahiti? It's not helpful. And you know, you've done this before, you've been on retreats before, and the last time it was Fiji. And the time before that, it was, you know, the beaches in France. And you know, out of bitter experience, that it's simply not useful. It doesn't help you. It's actually counterproductive. And so after a while, you realize this is not a good deal. And you have certain wisdom, and because you really see that, you're really convinced that this is not useful, it's easier to let go of it. And sometimes we might know superficially it's not a good deal, but the psyche hasn't really taken it in a very deep level. This is a dead end. To be filled with judgments by people and anger about what's going on in the past, it's just, why bother? You've known that this is really painful. This is causing yourself pain and suffering. The second is to cultivate the opposite quality, the antidote. And each of you can kind of, maybe it's best if each of you kind of think, what is the opposite of your particular hindrance for yourself? I ask people sometimes, if they're really struggling in something in meditation, to kind of ask them to kind of tell me, you know, some simple words. What is the key words? What are the key words that characterizes your struggles? And then they want to say, well, you know, when I was a child and this happened to me, and then this person said, no, not the story. Just the key words that characterizes how you are when you're having this bout of whatever's happening. And they say, oh, I feel angry and tight and resentful and discouraged. And then I said, great. Now, hold that in mind, how you feel. And then, what in your own body, your own sense, your own being, feels like the opposite of that rage and discouragement and tightness or whatever? And they, somehow, they, hopefully something pops up from deep in the psyche that seems like the opposite. Maybe peace, maybe strength, maybe love, something. And then I'll ask them to see if they can find some place in their body where that opposite quality exists. And then ground the attention in that place. If a person feels very insecure, maybe the opposite is strength. Can you find some place where there's strength? And sometimes people will say, oh, my feet, or my hands, or my torso, or something. Great, just hang out in your hands. And it can be very comforting and very settling to find that opposite and hang in with it. Sometimes it's said that if you're really struggling with a lot of discomforts, this is actually advice from the Buddha, a lot of pain, for example, sometimes the helpful thing to do is to find some place in your body where the opposite is happening. Find some place where there's some pleasure. And it might be that you're wrapped in pain, but if you spend some time looking around, you can find a little corner of your body, maybe a square centimeter someplace, that where it feels pleasant. I like the contact of my lips touching each other. That for me is kind of almost all automatically a pleasant sensation. Or sometimes if I touch my fingertips together, that's a kind of, actually for me, kind of a pleasant place. But different places I can, you know. And then bring the concentration to bear on that opposite quality, to let it grow and develop it, or rest there, or take a break there, to bring balance. That can be helpful. Sometimes it's more classically the antidotes. For example, the antidote, as I said, of ill will might be loving kindness. The antidote for desire might be the unbeautiful. It might also be cultivating contentment. What can you do to cultivate contentment? The opposite of doubt is inspiration, confidence. See what you can do to elicit confidence. Reflect on the qualities of the Buddha or the Dharma or spiritual practitioners you know who really inspire you. Or recite the Metta Sutta if you've memorized it, or some other text you memorize. Sometimes, I bet a lot of you, if you're filled with doubt, if you just recited the Metta Sutta in the middle of your doubt, it would probably settle it a little bit. Maybe it wouldn't go away, but probably change the context of it all and get you more settled. The antidote for restlessness is said to be concentration, which is a little bit a paradox here, if I'm telling you. The antidote for sloth and torpor sometimes is light, to bring light to bear on what's going on, or to stand up, or to do walking meditation, bring energy. Sometimes the antidote for the hindrances is to develop what's called a sky-like mind, a mind which is very spacious, sky-like, very accepting of everything that arises. It's kind of like Vipassana, just very, very, like the hindrances are just like these clouds drifting through an endless empty sky. Kind of maybe even use the imagination, your imagery, your powers of visualization to imagine this big empty sky. Another one, which is not very popular, wasn't maybe still not very popular in American Western psychotherapy, because it had, you know, it's a very bum rap. You know, it's not good. You know, this is like the last thing you're supposed to be doing. You go to your therapist to help you not do this. And but the nice thing is that maybe everything has a place. Anyway, this is suppression. Isn't that the terrible boogeyman of Western psychology? No, it isn't. Isn't that like the worst thing? It's like there's no place for suppression in a healthy life, right? Maybe they're right. But in Buddhism, maybe Buddhism is wrong. But for developing concentration, suppression is considered to be a valid strategy. When you do it, however, do it wisely. Know that you're doing it. Know why you're doing it, and be very careful with your motivation. Be sure you're not doing it because you're trying to run away from something. Do it because you think this is a really valuable strategy. It's much more useful for me to suppress this, get really concentrated, and really still and clear with my mind, so I can look at these issues really carefully, that clear mind. So suppression is an example. So suppression just partly is kind of bearing down, just ignoring, pushing away, denying, not thinking about it, holding those thoughts at a distance. And the fifth one that's classic is go for refuge. If you have, it's kind of part of like this inspiration thing. If you have a lot of hindrances, a lot of obstacles to you getting concentrated, recite the triple refuge. I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. And do it, this is like one of the most religious, faith-based kind of little rituals that Buddhists can do. And if you have that faith relationship to Buddhism, then you can use that as a way of helping you. And just stop your meditation for a few minutes and just recite the refuges for a while. And then once you feel settled and concentrated and filled with a certain level of confidence and faith, then begin again with the refuges, with the concentration practice. So this preparatory stage has a lot to do with learning how to work with the hindrances. And I've given you a lot of different ideas in brief. The difficulty with giving you all these ideas is that you'll be confused when you sit down what you should do. You'll be wondering and trying to remember and get all agitated, trying to think what's the right approach here. Try to be on the guard from being too agitated or too confused, too doubtful about what to do. But it's also helpful to have a range of these things kind of in the background and wisely know what to pick up at the right time to help you get more settled. In almost anything you do that keeps you engaged in the process of getting concentrated without getting filled with thoughts and discursive ideas and agitation that way, whatever, that engagement, that full engagement, everything we have, all our subjective factors, that's what we're, one of the things we're looking for is engagement. So even if you're using your intelligence, you know, to try these other antidotes, you're still engaged. You're engaged with something wholesome as opposed to the mind wandering off free and thinking whatever it wants. And there are times when you're engaged and you try different practices and it, you know, it's kind of rough first, or maybe it's agitating or confusing. But with time, you'll begin become smoother and easier. And more, you know, something you use to really help you with a focus of getting concentrated. So I hope this next week, as you sit, that when obstacles of concentration arise, that you don't let them discourage you, that you apply yourself more fully to the concentration. That your first strategy, I would suggest, is you try more fully. Try to put more energy, more effort, and more strength in your concentration to see if you can override the tendency to be distracted or be hindered. If that doesn't work, then see if you can work with the antidote to it, or see if you can work with wisdom or mindfulness so you can settle it and come back to get on track again with the work of concentration. And with time, what we're aiming towards is developing a strength of mind where the mind becomes independent of distractions, independent of the forces around it. And the classic image, one of the classic images of this, or that can be used for this, is a lotus growing out of muddy water. A beautiful white lotus, when it comes out of the muddy water, it blooms and it's completely pure and untarnished by the mud. But it grew out of the mud. So out of the mud of our lives, we grow a lotus. And the mind, which is independent of all the conditions of the world. An awareness, an ability to apply the mind, an activity of the mind, the ability to apply and use the mind that is unswayed and unpulled by all the things that can tempt it. Okay? So please continue with the practice. And if you haven't memorized the Metta Sutta, please make more efforts there also. And by all means, please enjoy this concentration practice. If you're not enjoying it, see if you can tinker with it a little bit to make it more enjoyable. Maybe you can make it, if you're not enjoying it enough, what's enough? I don't want to burden you, you know, with judgment. Oh, I'm not enjoying it, you know. You know, I'm not doing it right. But it can be helpful. It can be helpful sometimes to have the idea of being playful, that you're entering into the playground of the mind when you sit down to concentrate. So enjoy. Thank you.